roll a surf cart full of tackle and three 10-foot rods onto a crowded beach and soak bloodworms for croakers right where everyone is swimming.
You bring your favorite tackle, lures, a cooler of food and drink if you feel you need it, and away we go.
You get these guys that just left Wall Street a half an hour ago. They're like king of the world, and then they get on the boat and they can't cast.
Bro deserves a raise. And to that I say, bro could have also been restocking the thingamabobbers. Good morning, degenerate anglers, and welcome to Bent, the fishing podcast that relies solely on the Flex Seal family of products for everything from mending outboard fuel lines to turning any pair of pants into waders to making any live bait of soft plastic. I'm Joe Cermelli.
Miles Nolte, and I have no idea where this is going, but I feel like I need to be the voice of reason here and put out a little PSA. We have not picked up Flex Seal as a sponsor. Joe's not doing this out of obligation. This is not a hard sell. I don't know where the Flex Seal is coming from.
No, that's true. That's true. That's accurate. However, I wouldn't mind picking them up as a sponsor, because I'm about some Flex Seal. Matter of fact, the best fly fishing trick I know revolves around it. You want to know what it is?
Yeah.
Clear Flex Seal, in my opinion, is the best sealant for foam flies ever.
Clear Flex Seal?
Yes. Yes. So you didn't even know there was clear. You're not on the inside of the Flex Seal family of products, right?
I learned this
from my bud Carl Harris at CGH Custom Tackle. You actually own some of his bugs. He sent us some and I gave them to you.
I do.
And you guys should also, you guys listening should check him out. But anyway, Carl figured out that clear Flex Seal like adds a durable shell, but true to its name, stays flexible when dry. And I haven't used anything else to seal a popper or a foam bug since. But
really?
Right, bonus tip, you have to buy the jar of brushable Flex Seal, right? Uh-huh. Not the spray. Uh-huh. And double bonus tip, here's another bonus tip, pour it into a mason jar to store it because it's more airtight, like the can ends up not sealing
after
a while, right? Yeah. So pour it into a ball mason jar, seal it up, got a huge jar of the shit at my tying desk always.
Oh shit.
It's great stuff. It's great stuff.
I'm learning so much. The vase thing is I honestly, dude, I had no idea Flex Seal was even around anymore. I thought it died with Billy Mays. I don't know.
No, OxyClean died with Billy Mays. Billy Mays wasn't Flex Seal.
It's all the same to me. I will say that sounds like a great tip, and it's definitely legit if Carl gave it to you, because that dude makes some sexy baitfish imitation streamers.
He thinks outside the box, dude, with his patterns.
Yeah, the Montana trout definitely approve of those streamers he made. I have tested that out, and he also gave me some wicked looking frog patterns that I'm hoping to pin into some bass face later this summer. But even if you don't fly fish, which is fine, I happen to know who makes some wicked conventional frog lures.
Oh, that's funny. So do I.
Yeah.
That would be 13 Fishing, who we're very proud to say sponsors this show. And while I'm not going to give up a ton of the goods so that I don't ruin the next season of B-Side Fishing, let's just say I put their Trash Panda hollow body frogs, both the regular traditional body and the popping models, to work in Virginia recently, and the snakeheads responded extremely favorably. The Trash Pandas are tough frogs that they could take some serious abuse. I was very impressed by those frogs.
Snakeheads are more abusive than bass when it comes
much
to
more so. A lot more
lures.
Toothy.
A lot more toothy. More bite pressure too, I think. And I will say that few things bring me as much joy as frog fishing. I haven't done it actually since last summer. So I'm looking forward to that. And I am hoping that's the theme you're going with for this episode, because God, I hope it's not Flex Seal. I hope that's not the whole show.
It's not that either. It's about flexing in general. See what I did there, right?
Yeah,
and this topping,
see,
it's creative. Yeah. This topic has come up time to time, but this week I think we're going to go all in on the various ways in which anglers flex. And we all flex, even if we don't think we're flexing, which is sort of part of the fun. Like, we're going to expose your subconscious flexing.
Like meta-flexing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I dig it. Well, I mean, you know, the obvious one, and I don't think this is where you're going, but there's the obvious flex. It's the dude who's crowing about, I catch the biggest fish. I catch the most fish. Bro, look at me. And those guys are just assholes. So I'm guessing you're going to get more nuanced, and we're not just going to talk about those guys all day, because that would also suck.
No. And you're spot on, right? Because flexing over what you caught is just too obvious and kind of lame. Like, one example, one of my favorite flexes is just simply being right about a lure fly. And I know for sure you get this because you were a guide, right? You're out with somebody that's struggling a bit and just like insistent on fishing a certain way. And you're like, hey, man, just look, just switch to this for a little bit. Just trust me. And you're right. Like, that's a good flex. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That is. And because I'm at the point in my fishing, and I mean this, where I enjoy seeing the people I'm with catch fish as much as I enjoy catching fish, it's like a double win. Because I'm happy about their success, but I also just got to flex a little bit.
Totally.
So it's great. It's terrific.
Yeah. I mean, similar to that, I feel like the ultimate form of what you're talking about is seeing a stranger, like a complete stranger you don't know, on the water struggling while you've got it dialed.
This is good.
And then just going up to them unprompted and offering advice. And like, it's the best, because you get to be both magnanimous and kind of an egotistical ass at the same time, right? Like, you are both the nice guy, but you just flexed on him. And there's also the opposite side, which used to happen sometimes while guiding, right? And I'd know that we had tied on exactly the right thing. I'd know what they were eating and how, and we're using the right thing. But the clients still weren't catching fish because they weren't listening and they weren't fishing it right. Right? Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I'd get the, do you think we should try something different? Right? And at that point, like, I hated to do it, but I have to take the rod and then like hook three fish on three consecutive casts and just hand it back and say, no, I think we should stick with that. I think we're good.
That's a good one. That's great. I said, now another one I love, I also really love, and this sounds shitty, but it's true, I love catching fish behind somebody.
Oh yeah.
And that might be the best flex of all. And for me, at least, like, it's a scenario, at least, I don't end up in very often, and you wouldn't, unless you're kind of the guy that goes out looking to do this to prove a point. But every once in a while, right, you just unknowingly step into that scenario where someone is where you want to be, and you're watching them just going, they're not fishing that effectively at all. And you don't push them out, you don't make a scene, you just bide your time close by, wait for them to give up the ghost, and just slide in and connect. That's a thing of beauty.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And you still don't comment or rub it in. You just keep to yourself, but you know they know, right? And like, I'm trying to think. The last time that happened to me, this was years ago. It was on a Steelhead River in Ohio, and it was glorious. It's just glorious.
You described this as a rare occurrence, but this happens all the time, fishing out of drift boats on the popular
river. Good point. Here. Where you're like, fishing, yeah, I could see that.
It's
all
the time. Like, that was the game. It still is the game. And jumping ahead of another boat, like rowing around another boat to get to the water before them is that's a dick
can't
move.
Do that.
That's a no-no.
Can't do that.
Cannot do that. But there's nothing wrong with hanging back and just mowing someone else's lawn, as my good guide buddy used to call it. It's like, it's the public yet quiet flex.
Yep.
And it's just, it's satisfying.
Yep.
It's satisfying.
Very.
And,
very much.
And despite the fact that I do like those more quiet, more low-key flexes, that's that's more my style. Sometimes you got no choice. You just got to be overt about it. People from New York City and the boroughs, like out near where you are, they kind of already have that reputation. Like, the Jersey Shore thing is all about overt flexing.
Oh, you don't say.
I think that's what the situation majored in.
That's right.
And on that topic, all that, like, that fact about that area makes the story we have for Smooth Moves this week extra sweet. This is the part of the show where we get guides and captains and shop workers and anyone else who makes a living in the fishing industry, and we bring them on and we let them bitch about dumb things their clients do. And today, we are joined by Staten Island's native son, Captain Frank Crustatelli.
Why did you do that? Why? Why did you do that, Karen?
All right, joining us today on Smooth Moves, our buddy Captain Frank Crescitelli. What's going on, Frankie?
Hey, Joe. How you doing?
Good. It's good to see you. And man, there's so much to set up about you. So you're a veteran captain in the New York City area, originally from Staten Island, right?
Yep. Born and raised.
Born and raised. And you've had a huge hand in conservation work in the striper scene. You have a TV show. fin chasers. Sure. You're a man. You have irons in many, many fires.
Yeah. And there's like, weren't you also a mechanic? And there's kind of other business. I don't. You've done everything, man. Like there's, I mentioned anything. Like, oh yeah, I did that for a couple years.
I did do a lot of different businesses. I was an auto mechanic by trade, and I had gas stations, repair shops, and that until we decided to have kids, and then we figured that, you know, somebody had to raise the kids, you know, so I got out of that business, and it was changing dramatically, but. Yeah, we had used cars, rentals, cellular phones. I was doing cellular phones since 1987.
Oh, man. And then all right.
You figured being a charter captain would give you more time with your family. Yeah. I bet that didn't really work out.
What happened is once the kids got into full-time school, then I actually went to a Tony Robbins seminar, and I had to figure out, like, what was I going to do? And I decided – yeah, man, I love fishing. If I can make that a business, you know, and I signed up right there that Monday when I got out of the place, and I signed up my buddy Dino as well. He had no choice. I went to his house, dialed the phone number for the captain's phone, and put the phone in his hand. So
that is the best origin story I've ever heard.
You've made it work. I mean, there's so many things. You also run the Manhattan Cup tournament, which I fished. On the actual like charter for hire, how many years have you been a captain for hire, man?
So this year would be like 22 years. So the last few years, not, you know, only very special people because I've been focusing on the video and TV stuff. And the challenge in the beginning was just that. You want to take people fishing when it's good. But you also want to film when it's good, and it's hard to film even when it's good.
Yeah.
You know, the camera comes on and the fish disappear. You know, it was a time where I did like 160 trips a year for a bunch of years. Sure. I was doing six a week and grinding it out. And 75% of my business comes from Manhattan. So I would drive from Staten Island to, you know, 23rd Street, pick these people up. And then start to trip from there, you know, when market closed stuff, mostly afternoons. And then fly fishermen would come in the morning. And it was great when the fishing was great. And then not so great when the fishing was, you know, tough.
I always have so much respect for the salty guys because, like, unlike a river, the fish aren't always there every day.
Right.
Like, they could just not be there. But you do the fly thing, you do inshore, you also have spent a lot of time offshore. So I'm very curious with this smooth move, where are we going? Are we going inshore, Manhattan? Are we going offshore to the canyons? Knowing where you pull so many clients from that area, you got to have something good for us.
I really hate to, like, try and correct people or, like, put them in their place, like about if they're wrong. But sometimes I get on board with very strong opinions about
you're from Staten Island. Isn't that what you do if you're from Staten Island? Correct people and put them in their place?
Yeah. And it would be, you know, you got to remember, like, you're getting these guys that just left Wall Street a half an hour ago. They're making multi-million-dollar deals, right? They're like king of the world, you know, Matthew McConaughey beating on his chest and everything. And then they get on the boat and they can't cast. And I'm trying to help them, and it's making it worse. And then they're like, oh, no, you know, my rod and this and that. And I'm like, dude, you just got to shoot line. Just relax, chill out, you know, whatever. And so, you know, this one guy was really giving me a hard time. And we were having a hard time fishing. We were marking fish everywhere, but we could not hook up. So finally he goes, you know, you keep talking about these marking these fish. You know, that thing probably looks like that all the time. You know, for 3 hours, you've been saying, there's fish.
Oh.
So I said, oh, you think that that's not working? He goes, yeah. I go, okay, hold on a second. Reel them in. And everybody starts reeling. I start moving away before everybody really reeled their lines in, right? And my mate's looking at me. And I hit the throttle. And we're flying offshore now. We were right by Breezy Point, and I drive 3 miles straight out into the shipping channel. And I stopped the boat, and everybody's looking at me like, what the hell is going on? So I tell the guy, come here. They bring him over the sound. I said, you see? No fish. Now, if you want, I'll take you back to at least where the fish are, and maybe they'll start biting in there. And the guy was just like, oh, boy, okay. And just so then it's funny. On the way back, I decided I'm going to check the Rockaway Reef because I already drove these guys already offshore.
Right.
And I you swing may as well. Back in yeah. a little bit. And I go, now you see, that's bait and fish on the machine. And the guy's like, yeah, okay, I got it. Like, you know, like I was rubbing his face. I wasn't rubbing his face. I'm trying to show him this is a little different. This is bait and fish, like a little more ingredients, you know? And so he's looking at his friend like, and he doesn't even touch a rod. And the guy who knows the least, you know, barely fished, is, I go, take that little diamond jig and put it over and just, you know, jig it. And he catches an albie. And the guy was like so pissed off that, you know, that he didn't believe the whole program. But usually guys go along with, you know, whatever you want to do. And I just want people to have fun. So, like, if they want to sit there and drink beer and eat sandwiches and don't worry about fishing, that's fine. But, you know, you usually got to balance it up. And the challenge is the market closes the same time every day. Doesn't care what time, what the tide is, what the wind is. You got to be back in 4 or 5 hours because then they're going to go to dinner after that. So you had a very small window to find fish every day. And it was
interesting,
man.
So, you know? Like a lot of your deal, like you were literally picking guys up in the south end of Manhattan, like in the financial district to fish when the market closed between that and their fancy dinner.
Yep. And their clients would never forget, right? I mean, they could take you to how many $100 steaks could these guys eat in their life? And they forget where they went, but they never forget if a guy takes them fishing and then takes them out to dinner. So that's how we built that whole thing on there.
Like, I know you don't, you want everybody to have a good time. You're mellow. We've hung out. I know your program, but at the same time, I also know that sometimes as a captain, you got to flex a little bit.
Oh yeah.
Because otherwise people aren't going to trust you. And if they don't trust you,
right,
they're not going to catch fish because they're not going to listen to you. So every once in a while you have to pull that power move to be like, oh really? Let me show you. And then all of a sudden, like, oh, they believe you and they get a little more sheepish. And all of a sudden they start catching fish. So nobody, well, not nobody. I never like doing that. I can tell you don't like doing it, but sometimes you have to do the flex if you want the day to work out.
Did you get invited to all the dinners, all the power dinners?
No, I drop them off. They go eat. And then I got to drive 16 miles home, clean the boat. And then, you know, by then it's 11 o'clock and then do a fly trip in the morning or something, you know? So if people don't think it's hard work, man, it's hard work.
Listen, don't be surprised if you hear more from Captain Frank on Bent down the road a piece. Or maybe, just maybe, see him in season 3 of Das Boot, which is in the works right now. Anyway, Frankie is so fun. And he was actually telling us that in those days when he was guiding all the Wall Streeters, it wasn't uncommon for these guys to show up at the boat still wearing black wingtips and a suit, which is funny. Because in their world, like, that look alone is a flex. You know what I mean? But as soon as you're trying to pull it off on a striper boat, you're doing the opposite of flexing. Like, you just look dumb. But he said that was very common, you know?
Yeah. I like that story for a lot of reasons. But one of the things that I think it brings up, and this is true in my experience, like Frank was saying, most guides, like the good guides, people I consider good guides, they don't want to flex.
Yeah, of course.
Like, the flex is the nuclear option that should only be used when all else fails. And the clients just won't listen to you or won't believe you. But you do have to pull that card when you're forced to. Ultimately, you're the captain of the boat. And if your crew, if your sports lose faith in you, that's a problem. And you got to get that shit back one way or another.
Sure. But I mean, unfortunately, right, too many charter guys use that business model, though. They just,
like, that's
stake
what they
everything.
Start out doing is the flex instead of using it to fix a problem. Like, that's how
exactly.
they go.
Exactly. Yeah. They just stake everything on this over-the-top bravado about how they outfish everyone. And I know that works for some people.
I'm the best fisherman on shore. Believe that. Believe that. No one can handle me. I haven't been making videos lately, but I'm still out here catching fish all the time. I catch them all the time. Believe that.
It's unclear, however, whether it worked for the gentleman we recently discovered looking for a fishing buddy on Craigslist.
I don't think it did. My guess is
probably not.
It did not. But please let us know if you would have been sold on the skills up for grabs in this week's sail bin.
Well, why did you put the ad in the paper if you don't know what I'm getting at?
Well, you didn't have to be so hurtful with me, so angry.
So this week's sail bin item isn't exactly an item. In fact, it's not even for sale. Okay, this comes from
it's not
Craigslist
in a bin.
It's not in a bin. You won't find it in a bin
you can't
or a
put
tub.
It in a bin. Yeah. Nope. Really, really kind of losing the thread here, but it makes sense. It'll make sense.
It's going to make sense. Okay, and this comes from Craigslist, Philadelphia, and it's from the barter section, which I have to admit, I don't think I'd ever looked at until this came along.
Nope.
right?
I didn't even know it existed until this came up. And I've bought and sold things on Craigslist before. Mm-hmm. I've done that, but never gone to the barter zone. And it feels sketchy. Mm-hmm. Like, that feels sketchy to me. Mm-hmm. Buying and selling stuff, you know, you've done the Craigslist thing. Like, mm-hmm. buying and selling stuff with strangers, it's already a little awkward, right? It's fun when you're just scrolling through pics of stuff and you're like, oh, I want exactly. that and I want that. But then you got to actually meet up with those people. And it's weird. It can be, not always. Sometimes it's fine, but sometimes it's weird. And I just imagine that the barter experience is 10 times worse.
Oh, yeah. And I haven't bought a lot of stuff off Craigslist, but the most recent purchase was a tugboat-shaped sandbox for my son, right? And I ended up in a not-so-good part of Philly. And while the person I was communicating with was, like, very clear and concise via email and text, I ended up dealing with, like, an old Polish lady that just pointed and never, like, she never spoke to me.
Speaking of awkward.
The yard was just full, like, literally piled with beat-up plastic playground equipment. And it was very strange. I got the boat, though, you know.
No, that does, it sounds strange, but that was legitimately completely worth it, because I've seen that tugboat sandbox. That thing's fantastic. If my kid actually knew that existed, he would be racking his little brain right now trying to figure out what he could trade for it, because he would want it.
I don't want to get off, but it's called the Tuggy. It's discontinued, and it's actually a hot item. It's a very coveted item, that sandbox. Oh. There's even people who have, like, filled it with foam and made little boats with trolling motors. There's, like, a whole Tuggy culture that I'm now a part of. I get the Tuggy newsletter. Anyway, it's not up for barter. So anyway,
clearly
but
not.
I was recently scrolling through the barter section of the Central Jersey Craigslist because I became curious. Because of this post we got. And it's trippy, man. I quickly realized this is where the weird deviant shit now goes down on Craigslist, since they got rid of the blatant, you know, click here for weird deviant shit page, you know?
Yeah.
So just like a few quick examples. And this is 10 minutes of scrolling. This wasn't like hours of searching. There was a post offering 100 ladies' handbags that read, $100 takes all the bags in the picture. Maybe barter one or two of them. Let me know what you're good at.
Ooh.
I mean, dude.
Ooh, yeah. That is a question that I can almost guarantee I would never answer that question if it was asked to me by some random dude on the internet. Let me know what you're good at. Ugh.
Yeah.
That's icky.
Yeah, dude. It's icky. And then there was a guy trying to trade a painting of George Washington for a laundry list of items that included steel ISO shipping containers, mushroom production equipment, a drone with an HD camera, sliding compound miter saw, or a Fitbit smartwatch.
That's a weird, random assortment.
It's whacked out.
I don't know, man. This, just talking about this is making me think I should. I'm not sure if this is making me think I should spend more time checking out the barter section, or if I have made the right choice in avoiding it. It could really go either way. But listener Nick Dombrowski, he's obviously chosen that he should hang out there, that it's worth it, because he sent us a post titled 4 to 5 hour fishing trip for barter. And I think we got to say that the gentleman that posted this is no Jerry the Canoe Salesman.
No.
When it comes to the wordsmithing.
No.
But it's still pretty good. Mm-hmm. And to give the guy credit, at least he knows how to post a photo. And in this case, he chose a shot of a largemouth bass. I'd say a relatively impressive largemouth bass reproduction mount. So let's begin. And just so everyone understands my yelling tone, the post was written in all caps.
It's got to be read this way, because that's how I perceive it as well.
So. Yes. I will trade a 4 to 5 hour fishing trip on my boat on the waters of Penn Warner. We will pitch lures like spinners and crankbaits at the docks or shoreline structures, slow fish plastics or jigs, troll lures for bass, pike, and pickerel, whatever you like. You bring your favorite tackle, lures, a cooler of food and drink if you feel you need it, and away we go. That's how I hear it.
I know. So before we go on, I just got to add, I actually live right near Penn Warner, and it's a bunch of private lakes that I actually think are owned by a waste management company. They're stocked, and you have to have a membership to fish it. So I just want everyone to understand that the pot is actually being sweetened here by this being private water. However, there are these huge lakes. There's also plenty of natural you know, fish reproduction. And there's also a shitload of members. So even though it's private, they get pounded. I've fished it a handful of times. And what I'm basically saying is just because it's private, it's not automatic. Like the fishing can still suck there. So it's not that, the pot is not sweetened not that, good. That much. Right.
Yeah.
So let's go on. I am bartering my time, boat, and knowledge. I have been out and caught bass and pike already, so it only gets better as the spring progresses into summer. We would probably start 6 or 7 a.m. until whenever. I am not a professional fisherman or a guide of any sorts. I am just a fisherman of over 55 years with many trophies to my name looking to go fishing.
So you just explained, like, it's private water, but it's not necessarily that good. And
right.
he tells us you can't use his rods and reels. And you're on your own for lunch if you think hunger is going to be an issue for you.
You think you might get hungry. If you're human, you handle that. Exactly.
But there's also there's a contradiction here in that he says you'll start at 6 or 7 a.m. until, quote, whenever. But if you look at the title of the post, then you'd be done by noon at the latest. And all
the very
so
latest.
My take, the way that I interpret this is that the length of the day, the duration you get to fish will be solely based around whether or not he likes you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think this is a good comparison to Jerry, because like Jerry, this guy, he's looking for a friend.
Mm-hmm.
He just can't say that. He's acting like he needs a little something in return when he really just wants a fishing buddy.
Yep.
But here's the closing. We'll finish it up. Just looking to trade a day of fishing to see what people offer. I can only take one person, as that's what my membership rules dictate. There will be no money exchanged. I charge nothing, just a barter of something. Let me know if interested and let me know what you have to trade.
it's so vague, right? So what is the value of this trip? And I'm really asking, like, at least
I don't know.
At least the guy with the George Washington painting stood firm that it was worth four grand, yep. Which is why he felt he could ask for a drone and a bandsaw. But like, dude, how do you even approach this? Like, base it around what? A guide's day rate? That doesn't seem right.
He's not guiding you.
Yeah, what's offensive? If I said I'll give you a book of Burger King coupons and a case of Natty Light, are we good? I don't know. A weed whacker that needs some TLC. What's acceptable?
I don't know.
Wouldn't know how to approach it.
My gut in a situation like this is, because this is how I was raised, I think of food, right? I would offer a nice lunch. But the dude has already made it clear that he thinks needing to eat or drink while fishing is a sign of weakness. So I don't think that's the angle that you want to take. Like, I don't know. I got a shitload of hats. I'm sure you do too. Maybe
many.
Like I'll give you five hats. I don't know. I think the only solution we have is that you live out there, dude. You got to test this and see what it'll take. Maybe you could go, dude. You go big. You offer him like a new 13 rod and reel setup and just blow his mind, because you know he's going to take that. And then, but the caveat is that you get to record the whole day for the podcast. I dare you. I dare you to do this.
Oh, dare, huh? Wow. Like what? Like what? Like double dog? Triple dog?
This is double dog territory.
Okay. Because don't tempt me with a good time that could actually be a complete nightmare. Are you familiar with the film Tusk? Anyway.
Vaguely. Yeah.
We'll see. Maybe. I'll consider it, because it could also be great. Anyway, Nick, thanks for this. And to everyone else out there, don't overlook those barter pages. Clearly, we are missing out on some gems. Dare I say, maybe even the better, creepier gems. And when you find something juicy, shoot that link to bent@themeateater.com. Well, that guy has plenty of trophies to his name, and I'm always looking to add another trophy to my name for supplying the most poignant fish-related news stories. So here comes that weekly flex of internet searching ability we call fish news.
Fish news!
That escalated quickly.
Quick follow-up on last week's Sailbin segment when we made fun of the explosive hook fish net, which is like a castable throw net with bait in case you missed it. A couple of you sent links to YouTube videos, which sent me down this rabbit hole that I probably should have explored before we did the segment. Would have been
good. Have we had an oopsie?
We might have. I will keep it short. Long story short, It turns out this product is actually incredibly popular just in Southeast Asia, not here. And over there, they're commonly called spring bomb nets. I actually watched one video where there's this tiny little pond, and the banks of this pond are just lined like shoulder to shoulder with people, and all of them, every single one has a spring bomb net at the end of their spinning rod line, all of them. So it turns out if you're a subsistence fisherman in Southeast Asia targeting tilapia and cichlids in your local pond, these are highly effective and they make perfect sense, right? Some of these videos actually feature Cambodian kids who, if I'm being honest, they clearly live in poverty and they're using spring bomb nets to like help feed their families. And what I can't figure out is how they self-film their adventures or upload them to YouTube, but such is the world that we live in, right? Like YouTube channels are cheaper than shirts now, it seems. Anyway, the whole thing made me feel like kind of an ass, dude, if I'm going to be honest. I made fun of something that's like feeding hungry people, and we're fortunate enough to live. Like, we're fortunate enough to not need spring bomb net, right? We don't need that.
Okay, here's what I'm going to say, though. I think like where we failed was that we said it doesn't work, right? We couldn't figure out how it would work, but clearly it does, right? So, it does. Okay, fine. We screwed that part up. But like we found it on a site that was marketing it to U.S. anglers. So like we're still allowed to, I don't feel that bad.
Like, no, you know. I'm not losing sleep. But I don't think these are going to catch on in the U.S. anytime soon. But they certainly have a market. We just missed it.
No. Plus, you send them kids a case of trout magnets, they'll forget all about their nets. They'll light them up. Anyway, speaking of feeling like an ass, I actually have sort of a correction this week. It's actually not really a correction, but more proof that I'm just somewhat slow. You did that story about the fishing tourney with old Walter the smallmouth, right?
Yep.
And it was like, if you caught it, you got $100,000, but you had to catch it over a weekend, and then the prize dropped to $1,500. And I said this was shady because, like, this marina has 100K sitting around to give. It's weird. And a bunch of people wrote in and were like, hey, dimwit, like you take out an insurance policy for something like that. Like,
really?
When people are putting up a bunch of money as a cash prize where it's like a competition like that, apparently the insurance payment is less than the prize value and the insurance company is just hoping someone doesn't win.
Huh.
So they're like, no, of course they don't have $100,000 sitting around. They have $1,500 sitting around, which is why the prize dropped to $1,500 after the weekend. But that once it was said, it made total sense in my head and reiterated why I could never own my own business because like finances are lost on me. I do not understand such grown-up things. My head never went there. But so thanks for that, everybody. Final thing before we get in the news. You know those fish eating fish t-shirts and hoodies we've just been cramming down your throats? We've decided to give one of each away. You know why? Because we're cool like that.
It's true.
How about that? Yeah.
We are cool like that, and we don't need a special occasion to give you shit.
No,
so,
we don't.
So, for 1 week and 1 week only, kind of similar to how we've done giveaways in the past, those Degenerate Angler and Bent Podcast hashtags are worth more than stickers.
That's right. So to qualify, we're looking for the pictures using those tags posted between today, which is June 25th, and next Friday, which is July 2nd. In other words, you got to do this between now and when the next episode airs.
Yeah.
And I don't know, make us laugh, gasp, wince, cry. I don't know. But we'll pick one of our favorites, and Miles and I will post the winner on Saturday morning, July 3rd, on our Instagram accounts. And somebody is going to get a fresh fish-eating fish tee and hoodie, and you will look sharp.
It's like a cornucopia of degeneracy, much like this show. All right, moving on to fish news. Quick reminder that this is a competition. Joe and I do not know what the other is bringing to the table, and we are, as always, competing for the love, affection, and validation of our patron saint of all things auditory, Phil the Engineer, who will declare one of us a winner and relegate the other to a week of self-doubt and questioning of life choices. Joe's got the lead this week.
Yeah, and if I win, Phil gets a hoodie, and if you win, he gets the t-shirt. So there's more incentive for me to take the it's a nice weight, the hoodie. Anyway, so here's where I'm going to start. This comes from our Canadian listeners. Several of them alerted me to this story, and it's pretty interesting and sort of speaks to like fish perceptions by country and region. So here in the U.S., of course, bass are the king dog, number one most coveted fish in the U.S. And I'm mainly talking largemouths there, but we love a nice smallmouth here as well. Well, certain conservation groups in New Brunswick, Canada, flipping hate smallmouths right now. And they hate them so much that they're willing to poison the famed Miramichi River to get rid of them. Okay?
Oh, I've heard about this. This is a big deal.
Right? So, smallmouth, just so we're all on the same page, are not native to New Brunswick. They were first found in Miramichi Lake in 2008. And it's believed that they were illegally stocked by bucket biologists. Somebody thought these would be great to catch here and put them in. So this story comes from CBC News, and it says, a growing population of smallmouth bass in Miramichi Lake, Lake Brook, and a portion of the southwest Miramichi River has been threatening Atlantic salmon as well as brook trout native to the waters, salmon conservation groups say. Smallmouth bass threaten salmon and trout by taking over their food and habitat, said Neville Crabb, a spokesman with the Atlantic Salmon Federation. They can also threaten other native species around them. So the federal government has officially greenlit the eradication of the smallmouths by spraying the fish-killing pesticide Rotenone starting this August. And, of course, this got my attention because I know that the Atlantic salmon is to the Canadian Maritimes what stripers and largemouth are to the U.S. And, I mean, look, the Miramichi isn't some little no-name trickle, right? Like, this is big, hallowed water. And naturally, the first thing I thought was, how are you gonna Rotenone these areas and not have it affect the salmon? Because, and this is directly from the story, the product will kill the vast majority of fish in the waters being treated. According to an authorization document from Fisheries and Oceans Canada, the death and decomposition of fish will modify the food web, the fish habitat, ecological structure, and the nutrient input of the waters. But as it turns out, right? So some of the salmon conservation groups are pushing the hardest for this and actually wanted it to happen last summer. But it got roadblocked by the government, partially because a lot of people with waterfront homes on Miramichi Lake were just worried about dealing with piles of decomposing fish and their kids swimming in the lake and such. And residents are still complaining about all this. Some have been told they'll have to avoid the lake for several days, but the spraying is happening. They'll start on August 15th. And some waters may actually receive a second dose in September. Now, the salmon conservation groups are participating in the spraying of 17.2 kilometers. And according to the story, to mitigate the number of Atlantic salmon affected by the Rotenone, salmon will be captured and held elsewhere prior to releasing the pesticide. Barriers will also be installed to prevent salmon from entering the area being sprayed. Those barriers will be removed once a water purifier has deactivated the pesticide, allowing salmon and trout to migrate back in. Crabb said the Rotenone will not be at concentrations lethal enough to destroy all fish in the water. Brown bullhead catfish and golden shiner, for example, are expected to survive. So the salmon folks are saying, yeah, this is harsh, but, you know, look, people come to New Brunswick for Atlantics. They are the biggest economic driver. They are what people expect to catch in these rivers above all else. A growing smallmouth population would drastically alter the ecosystem. So this is what has to be done. But this is where it sort of gets a little bit sticky, right? The New Brunswick Aboriginal People's Council, on the other hand, is saying, hey, listen, we're already catching smallmouths in areas outside the ones you guys are saying has them. They've already flushed the system. They're not confined. So this is all going to do more harm than good. They're saying, you know, you're forgetting about insects and birds, stuff like that. Like, is that even being considered? To further back up their claim, the story cites a 2009 Department of Fisheries and Oceans report that says, if these smallmouths get into the southwest Miramichi, eradication efforts will be pointless. And they're there. They were first spotted there in that section of the river in 2019. So it's a whole dilly of a pickle here, but they are moving on with the spraying.
Oh, that is a tangled web. All right, first is a procedural question. They have a way of moving the salmon out.
I would love to know what that is, but they did not go into that.
I was thinking
the same thing.
The piece that doesn't seem to fit for me, because if you have a way of moving the salmon out, why wouldn't you have a way of capturing the smallmouth? Like, I would think those would be one and the same.
Exactly. And if I had to guess, like, they know that there's going to be death there that they don't want. Like, I don't know how you could possibly get them. You're not going to get them all.
You're not.
You know, so I don't know, man. To me, I definitely see both sides of this, and I know how ravenous smallmouth can be, although it's ironic because I live in a place where, like, the smallmouth fishing has really tanked. You know what I mean? Like, these big, aggressive fish that take over everything. So it's just funny to see it sort of both ways, but it just comes back to that, like, mentality of we are salmon country. Salmon, 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 salmon. Whatever you have to do to protect salmon.
Having spoke to some people in this area in the past, I know that there's like significant concern over smallmouth and pike being right in those waters and having a negative impact on the brook trout and the salmon, and both of which are fish that are experiencing declines anyway, and they don't need any more problems, right? So I get it. I understand the issue at hand. I'm not sold on this mitigation effort. It kind of seems like too little too late, and it might have cascading effects that people aren't thinking about. You know what I mean?
Agreed. I mean, 2008, like, that would have been the time to do something drastic when they first found them in this lake, in my opinion.
Yeah. But that's sort of how bureaucracy works. And I also, like, to play devil's advocate, you want to do enough preliminary research to understand what you're doing and try and think about the consequences that come from that. So I hope that's what they were doing and they figured all those things out, and that's why it took this long. If that's the case, then maybe they know more than we do. But I'm skeptical. I have some skepticism, but I don't feel like I know enough to really, like, make a firm declaration. But it seems like this one, the ship has sailed, or this smallmouth has swum.
I completely agree with that. And again, like, there's no way to really know, but it just takes you back to rivers in general. Like, how many rivers have you fished where somebody's like, well, all the brown trout are in this stretch, but then other people are like, no. They're way down here. Yeah. Like, they're here too. And there's some here and there's some there. So just in my opinion, especially when you're dealing with moving water, still water a little less, it's like you can be like, well, all the smallmouth are here. No. If they're there, most of them might be there. Yeah, if most of them might be there, but rest assured, they're already. So I don't see how this works. I really don't. The odds of this killing every smallmouth and wiping this problem out, I think, is slim to none.
I think you're sadly probably right, and it ties a little bit into my first story, which also has to do with, like, a scaling and growing problem that seems to be booming exponentially, and managers really grasping at whatever they can find to try and keep things under control and put the genie back in the bottle. As you're likely aware, coral reefs are kind of a big deal. They're kind of important. they're the primary protective barriers that shield coastlines from waves and storms and erosion. They're also the most abundant marine ecosystems on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they only cover about 2% of the ocean floor, but they house at least a quarter of marine life, which is pretty freaking amazing if you think about it. And so my point is basically, if you like fish, and I'm guessing that you do, you should probably care about coral reefs. That should be a thing that matters to you.
I agree.
And one thing I should clarify, coral and reefs, not the same thing. They're related, but they're not. Reefs can refer to any hard structure that forms an oceanic barrier. But most naturally occurring reefs are the result of coral. Coral are these tiny anemone-like organisms, and they secrete calcium carbonate, which is a hard substance that they live in. And that's what builds natural reefs.
Right.
So basically, to sum this up, you need the coral animals to both grow and maintain natural reefs, right? Because without the coral animals themselves, the reefs, they get broken and eroded, and then they're gone pretty fast.
Yeah, like basically, like, the dead shells left over don't do anything for you. It's got to be a living, breathing system for it to matter. Yeah.
Right. I mean, they matter for a little while, but not for very long. You need the whole thing. You need the animal there to keep things up, right? Yep. And as you may also be aware, I'm sure you are, coral's kind of struggling right now. It's got, you know, you got warming oceanic temperatures and higher acidity, and those are making coral colonies all over the world look like, they kind of look like the bison herd standing near Western train lines in the 19th century, just knocking over. It's not good. But just in case that analogy is not ominous enough, a new form of bacterial infection with the extremely literal name stony coral tissue loss disease was discovered on the east coast of Florida in 2014 and has now spread across the state and into the Caribbean. And it is real bad. Over 95% of Florida's coral reef has been affected. The disease spreads quickly, and once a colony shows signs of infection, it usually dies within weeks or months. The causes.
Ooh, that's fast.
Yeah, it's real fast.
Damn.
The causes and origins of this disease remain unknown, but we do know that it's killing off star, brain, pillar, flower, and maize corals primarily, all the way from northern Florida to Costa Rica. And those are the types of corals that contribute most to reef building and maintenance, like the big mm-hmm. structures. Those are the mm-hmm. ones that build the big structures that we like. Stony coral tissue loss disease can sometimes be stopped by applying amoxicillin to the affected corals, but doing that at scale is just not, like, it's just not realistic.
Yeah, right? we had a story a while ago, remember, about the treating the bacteria. What was it? They were trying to figure out how they could, like, treat coral reefs similarly with, like, and we couldn't figure out how to scale it. I don't remember the details right now. I feel like it had something to do with Greek yogurt. I don't know.
Oh, I remember. Yeah, yeah. It was like a probiotic thing.
Yeah, this probiotic. That's what I was looking for. Probiotic.
Yeah, probiotics for coral. Yeah, this is kind of similar, except instead of trying to help them grow, it's trying to prevent them from dying.
Yes.
And it was the same thing. Like, you can't.
I'd give them a shot of both. One, two. Boom, boom.
Oh, just like when you were 20. But right. I think the point is that, like, the amoxicillin is not going to solve this. So the Florida Wildlife Commission, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, and other nonprofit partners recognized the severity of this disease and the enormity of what could be lost if all these corals succumb to it. So in 2018, they initiated this program where they took samples of the highly susceptible corals from around all the state's reefs, and they transplanted them to inshore coral farms and aquariums across the country, right? And the idea of this is that they're creating they're basically trying to ensure that these local corals would not be completely eradicated, right?
Right.
So, and the hope being that, like, later on, that these specimens could be used to repopulate, like, future reefs in Florida.
Wow.
See what I'm saying? So last week, those same groups announced that they had successfully planted 1,152 coral colonies at 24 different sites from Jupiter to Key West from those stocks that were grown and maintained in coral farms and aquariums. According to FWC, the purpose of this project is to determine the fate of corals that are susceptible to stony coral tissue loss disease when outplanted across Florida's coral reef, where the disease is still present but no longer found in epidemic proportions. The knowledge gained during the study will pave the way for future expansions in the restoration of disease-susceptible corals. All right. Hold on. The language that they use there is important.
Okay.
No one's claiming victory or that there's a solution here, right? This project will help figure out what happens when affected corals get replanted in dead zones where the disease has already, like, ravaged and dwindled. A spokesperson for the Department of Environmental Protection said, understanding where and when it is safe to start outplanting species that are susceptible to stony coral tissue loss disease again is a major first step in restoring the resilience of Florida's coral reef. Now, he said first step. All those corals they planted might just get reinfected and die again, or some might survive. Either way, that's going to be useful information moving forward. But while most of the susceptible corals in the affected areas got infected with the disease and died, certain individuals survived, suggesting that those individuals have some kind of resistance. And earlier this month, the Florida Aquarium announced that they had successfully crossbred rescued brain corals with wild brain corals that resisted infection. In a press release, the aquarium said, quote, "The hope is that corals produced using this technique will be more resilient to future disease outbreaks and will help restore the Florida reef tract." Point is, not all hope is lost, at least not yet, right? The use of coral farms as both genetic seed banks to preserve the global diversity and like places to develop strains that are more resilient to disease, acidity, and heat is probably like the most promising technology that we have.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, much like those replanted corals in Florida last week, these are all possibly good steps. Like, this might help. And that's important because if global coral reefs collapse, which is like a super real possibility with all the things going on, we're in a lot of trouble. And like what's going on in Florida and these other groups like Coral Vita based in the Bahamas, essentially what they're trying to do is turbocharge coral evolution to stay ahead of the rapid changes happening in ocean ecosystems right now, which from like an objective standpoint is just interesting and cool. But from a personal standpoint, it offers this glimmer of hope in an otherwise totally dismal trajectory. And so I've just been following all of this.
Dude, it's fascinating, and like you have to applaud all of that. And there's certainly a glimmer of hope in that, right? Like that's a very hopeful thing. But also, like looking at it from a realist perspective, right? Because that's just what I do. So like this bacteria can kill off a reef in weeks or months.
Like not a whole reef, a colony.
A colony, okay. But like just looking at it from a timeline. So if this works, that's great. But like, how long would it? Truly, like maybe you don't know, but like how long would it take to repopulate that and like have that looking like nothing ever happened?
And it'll never be the same.
Right.
Right? Things have changed. But the idea is to maintain as much of that genetic diversity of different corals as possible and try and maintain what keep it at a healthy ecosystem and stay ahead of all these different changes coming in between acidity and warming and bacteria. There are all these different things happening to coral populations all over the world. And the hope is that this farming technique is going to do a couple things. One, keep that diversity alive when parts of the ocean just go dead. And also give them a chance to figure out what sorts of strains might survive those unique changing conditions, hopefully, and replant them. The timeline on that, no one knows. It's just
yeah, no, and I know there's no answer. I'm just like supposing out loud. It's like, it's great we can do that, but like, I just wonder, like, how would that translate to a mile of reef, like fully restored? You know, how long would, like, will we see that? Will our kids see that? You know, so.
A mile, yes. Just, the whole thing?
No.
Maybe our kids, maybe.
Well, maybe. I don't know. But look, I'll say, if things like we need as many people to care about things like this as they care about the TikTok video that I'm going to talk about.
That would be great.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
I'd call that a win.
So I actually hate to admit it, but this story might force me to rethink previous statements about refusing to get on TikTok.
Okay.
And this is you just gave us a very good weighty story about real life things. I've done no such thing here. There is not nearly as much value in this story, but it is a fun one. And it while it is fun, it also makes me question our society, which I always enjoy doing. So
yeah.
Anyway, this comes from the website of North Country Public Radio. Headline: Fishing for Customers Catching a Phenomenon. Okay, I don't know if you heard anything about this. So. I'm going to set this up, right? So I'm like paraphrasing the story. So an owner of a local toy store in Saranac Lake, New York, he's crossing an intersection in town and he spots a dollar on the sidewalk. He reaches down to pick it up. And of course, the dollar is magically whisked away. So he follows the dollar into Blue Line Sports, which is a fly shop. And he realized he'd just been pranked when Ryan Baker, a fishing guide with Adirondack Trout Fitters who works at Blue Line Sports, said, "Well, come on in, sir. How can I help you?" while holding a rod with the dollar dangling from the end. Now, look, that's the oldest trick in the book, right?
Absolutely.
Like a dollar on a string. Like, this is not new, okay? Well, that day, Baker and his roommate, Reed Mason, who's also a fishing guide, punked more than a dozen people with the old dollar bill trick. And I have to say, like, this is such a fly shop kid thing to do.
Oh God,
isn't it?
Yeah. I can see the conversation that led up
like,
to this.
Yeah. So like most of the time you walk into a fly shop and kids just like, you know, playing Mario Kart or like tying more squirmy worms or whatever. There's a lot of downtime. You know? There's a lot of downtime. So
the manager comes in and is like, "What? Sweep something.
Exactly.
Clean a window. I don't know."
Exactly. So I'm down with this as a way to occupy time and drum up a little extra business, which they did. They did with this little trick. Matter of fact, Baker himself said, "We just figured let's keep fishing. We're always fishing." So I put a dollar bill on the line and put it out on the sidewalk, right? So that's all cute and ha-ha funny. But Mason had been filming all the reactions to the prank, and he compiled a bunch into a single clip, set it to the SpongeBob SquarePants theme song, and posted it on TikTok. And this is from the story. Mason's TikTok account had something like 50 followers before this video went viral, according to Baker. Overnight, he gained more than 1,900 followers. His cell phone was flooded with notifications. Eventually, he had to shut off notifications, according to Baker. Quote from Baker, "It was constant. He showed me. He was like, dude, every time I refresh my feed, it's another 100, another 100, another 100. Every second, he would refresh his feed. So within 24 hours, the video racked up more than 1.6 million views.
Wow.
Okay. Now, first, good for you guys. Like, that's awesome, right? And they said it absolutely translated over the next couple of days into more bodies in the shop, which is also awesome. I'm happy for those guys, right? But the part that gets me is that, like, that's the thing that would get 1.6 million views, because again, hell, the dollar bill on a string thing has been around since paper money was invented, I think. Like, I fell for this on the boardwalk in Jersey when I was 10 and got laughed at by a bunch of kids smoking cigarettes in Napalm Death t-shirts. So I just can't believe that the dollar bill on a string thing still has that kind of juice in 2021. Like, people don't even carry dollars anymore. Like, if it's more than 10 bucks, I charge that shit. So, of course, the post was also lit up with comments. Here's just a couple. Bro deserves a raise. And to that I say, similar to what you just said, maybe bro could have also been restocking the thingamabobbers. You know what I'm saying? So
he, like, could have been, but I think this was a better use of his time,
In this case, it was a better use of his time, for sure. Then another one was like, honestly, I'd buy something. And, like, that's great for the shop if it's true. But, like, would you? Like, if you tricked me into a health food store, I wouldn't be like, ha, you got me. And while I'm here, give me a bag of them kale chips. So, you know, anyway, like, well played, boys. And I think it's fair to say that the TikTok algorithm is kind of wide open right now. Like, people have said that to me since the TikTok commentary. They're like, dude, the algorithm's wide open. I don't know. Maybe it's time to jump on that. But I thought this was a fun little story. Good for that fly shop.
I give props to both of those guides who were clearly bored, and I hope their manager recognized that what he might have thought was a waste of time and they should have been restocking or cleaning actually turned into something more valuable. So hopefully people are thinking about that. Like, oh, maybe we should give these kids some marketing responsibilities.
Yeah, and I'll tell you,
they're, like, smart.
I also feel like the dollar bill trick, like, I knew somebody who did it with a $10 bill once in college and ended up, like, almost getting beat down. Like, some people don't appreciate that trick.
No.
You got to watch that one. That can easily just turn into, you know, a knuckle sandwich. So,
and the other thing I'll say is that it's possible that the reason that people came chasing after that was because they were trying to figure out what it was. Like, what is that fluttery green thing I see on the ground, and where did it come from?
It's like a Bitcoin I can touch. Yeah.
Whereas that story covers a part of human culture where everything is maybe vapid and has no consequences, the one I'm going to talk about is purely consequence. And I got to say, this one really pisses me off.
Oh,
this one
grinds your gears. Grinds your gears.
Really grinds my gears.
All right.
Couple weeks ago, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife sent out a news release in regard to a series of steelhead poaching incidents that occurred last winter. So Oregon DFW, they use fish traps to capture migrating steelhead so that they can harvest the milt and the eggs from these fish and then raise smolt in state hatcheries, right? And then release the smolt back in the rivers and keep steelhead around.
Okay.
One of the places they do this is an area of Woodward Creek, which is a tributary of the South Coquille River. And that area is closed to the public and not easily accessible. That's why they do the trapping there. Biologists set the traps, and then they rely on local volunteers to check them and say, like, hey, you got some fish in there. Go check them.
Right.
The biologists then remove the fish, and they spawn them. But last winter, they ran into a problem. According to district biologist Mike Gray, we would get a call from a volunteer saying there were 6 or 7 fish in a trap. Then when we got there, the trap was empty. Or there was only one fish in it. We found evidence that the trap had been damaged, so we knew someone was getting in there. And this went on for weeks, right? They'd get calls saying, oh, fish are in the traps, and they'd come up empty-handed. Eventually, troopers set up surveillance cameras and caught 3 individuals on video the first night they did it. Those individuals and possibly others continued to return to raid the traps. One of them noticed the cameras, stole one, shot another out with his rifle, but he didn't get all the cameras. And so far, that individual, Kane M. Horner, is the only one of the poachers to have been identified. And fish traps weren't the only places where wild steelhead theft occurred in the area last year. Have you ever heard of broodstock boxes?
No, I mean, I know what broodstock is. I've never heard of a broodstock box, no.
I had neither. So this one's new to me. Apparently, this is something ODFW does. They set these boxes in rivers near popular fishing areas. And the anglers can, like, if you catch a steelhead,
right,
you can release it into that box and then let ODFW know, like, hey, I got a fish in the box for you.
Interesting. Got it. Right? Yeah. Cool. Okay.
And so anglers were doing this, and they were calling them in, and the biologist would show up, no fish in the box. Right. So these were also getting raided. Biologists ultimately had to resort to netting a bunch of the creeks and the rivers in that area to get enough steelhead to maintain their numbers. And that practice is both expensive and it's detrimental to the ecosystem and the steelhead. It's just a bad deal. It's not what they want to do. That's why they started doing the boxes in the first place. Now, I got to say, I'm not in favor of raising steelhead in hatcheries and releasing them in the wild, because hatchery fish have some negative impact on wild fish recruitment and survival. And it's a complicated topic with a lot of tension, and there are valid concerns on all sides. And I'm not going to get into all of that here, because that's not the point. The point is, when I first read this story, I thought maybe this was like an Ed Abbey monkey wrench gang style insurgency by wild steelhead activists.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
And if that were the case, I would not condone these actions, but at least, like, I could understand them.
Yeah, it's right? you have a cause of some kind, at least. Like, you have a belief. I get it.
And that's what I first thought. And so I'm like, okay, if these are like wild fish vigilantes, and they're breaking in fish traps and broodstock boxes, and they're setting the fish free as a way of increasing wild production and sabotaging the hatchery program so they can't get their numbers, like, I see that as idealistic if misguided. But the end of this story is that ODFW caught the one suspect identified on camera while he was illegally fishing in a section of the river that's closed to allow steelhead to spawn unmolested.
Yeah.
So
I figure that wasn't the answer.
They're
just dirtbags.
Yeah. Yes. They're not vigilantes. They're just despicable humans with no regard for fish. And they were just breaking into those traps and boxes to steal steelhead for themselves. The first arrest went down in February. And ODFW just sent out this press release, just recently, which to me, that suggests the investigation is stalled. And they're talking about it now because they're like, hey, anybody come forward with information, because we want to catch these other people. And I can't wrap my head around the sense of entitlement that a person would have to have to do something like this. But I don't know. Like... They didn't just steal from the hatchery. They stole from all of us.
Everybody. Yeah.
They stole wild steelhead, which are such a rare and diminishing resource. I find everything about this vile and despicable, and I do hope the punishment ends up fitting the crime. I actually can't even think of the best punishment for this. I don't know what it is. Should he be sentenced to spend the next 20 years working on habitat restoration? Like, is that valuable? Does that work? Should he be required to get poacher tattooed across his forehead in big black letters so he has to wear it like a scarlet letter? I don't know. I'd love to hear anybody's thoughts on what you think the punishment for this crime should be. I'm not holding my breath that we're going to get justice out of it, but I think it might be fun to hear what you all think should happen to this guy.
Oh, I'd love to hear. The poacher thing's great. That's not going to happen. The habitat restoration thing, though, dude, I like that. I like that a lot. But, you know, you talked about, like, motivation for this stuff, and, you know, the guy's stealing from everybody, and just reading so many of these stories with so many different kinds of fishery. And this one's definitely on another level because of how precious those fish are to begin with, you know, how rare. But I also feel like, you know, it's like murder. Like, everybody wants to know why, and sometimes the answer is because I'm just – a shitbag that doesn't care. Like, that's sort of like the end of the story. Like, we see it out here with stripers all the time. These guys poach all these stripers. None of them probably follow, or they just don't care about anybody else's conservation effort going on behind that. It's just, it's irrelevant. It's pure selfishness, and they just don't care. So I hate to say it, but I would guess these guys are not super in tune with the plight of the steelhead. Like, it's just like, there they are, and I need those. It's awful, but...
Ugh. I want to believe that there's more of a reasoning behind it. I want to believe there is some, like, coherent philosophy, even if it's at odds with my own. But maybe you're right. Maybe it's just blind, stupid, I want. I don't know.
I'm just curious. They probably didn't get into this, but... Like, is there any correlation between the phone calls and the group? In other words, like, were they checking all the time, or would they just seemingly get hit after somebody called and said there's steelhead in the trap?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I mean, how would they know?
Like, is there a ring? Is this like a ring? I'm joking, but I doubt it. I just think these are just dirtbags. They're everywhere, dude. In every they're everywhere. But this one is particularly
I want to think better of humanity than that. I don't think you're wrong. I want to assume that people have some sort of coherent reasoning for the shitty things they do. And I know that's not always true, but it helps me make sense of it.
Okay. Well, we'll see what Phil thinks about all of this, about the poaching, about the TikTok, about coral reefs, about killing off smallmouth. And then after that, we'll do a little weekly word and give you a new word to call somebody who you don't like, or maybe who poaches your steelhead.
All right, it's my favorite part of the week, where I get to choose which parent I would like to live with after the divorce. And this week, that parent is Joe Cermelli. What kind of an idiot falls for the old dollar on a fishing line trick? I mean, come on. all right, guys. Sorry to cut it short this week, but I have to run off to the Western Union. Don't mean to name drop or anything, but there's a Nigerian prince who could really use my help. And then after he pays me back with interest, I'm quitting this job, retiring early. I never have to listen to this shitty podcast again. F*** you!
Webster's Dictionary defines
fish
as...
We started this week's show in Staten Island, New York. But for the weekly word, we're going to hop on the Jersey Turnpike and make the two-hour drive south to Philadelphia. And this journey is actually by request of several listeners who have asked me to give an oral history of the term shooby, and that's S-H-O-O-B-I-E. Like most slang terms we've covered in this weekly word, John, shooby isn't tied directly to fishing, but it's used pretty often by anglers along the Jersey coast from roughly mid-state to the southern tip at Cape May. However, research shows that shooby can also be heard uttered in Delaware and even certain parts of Southern California. And that's all well and good, but I'm going to go ahead and say that even if there are shoobies in Cali in the first state, the term was still borrowed from the OG shoobies, which come from Philly. Shoobies, or shoobs for short, have been around since the late 1800s, and back in those days, the Jersey Shore was not the sprawling, crowded tourist scene it is today. In fact, only a select few areas of development even existed along the coast in the southern half of the state. Now these days, thanks to the Atlantic City Expressway, you can get from Philly to the beach in about an hour. Of course, back in the early 1900s, your fastest option was by train. And furthermore, the train was a relatively affordable option for poorer families in Philadelphia who would pack the cars on a Saturday morning for fun in the sun. Now, I've read accounts that the price of the train ticket also included a boxed lunch that came in a shoebox. I've also heard that after ponying up for that ticket, many families just didn't have enough money left over to buy food at the beach, so they carried their lunches to the beach in shoeboxes. Either way, the day trippers were easily identified by their shoebox lunch pails, and the term shooby was born. While shooby is alive and well, how one gets defined as a shooby has morphed over time. Shoobies making a day trip these days aren't hanging around Wildwood and Avalon eating stale bread out of a Buster Brown box, but according to Urban Dictionary, a shooby can be any person who looks out of place while at the beach, usually identified by the wearing of black party socks with shorts and flip-flops and or a severe sunburn. Other sources note that common shooby traits include pale skin, a lack of familiarity with local customs, and wearing shoes on the beach. However, Philly Magazine went all in 2010 with an article that featured a series of questions aimed at helping you figure out if you are, in fact, a shooby. Here are a few examples. Have you ever used wet towels as car drapes so pedestrians or other drivers can't see you shimmy out of your wet bathing suit? Have you ever spent more than 5 minutes getting your towel in the perfect tanning position to the sun? Do you carry enough blankets, towels, coolers, umbrellas, and other beach paraphernalia that your family looks more like a safari expedition when you finally get to the beach? Do you go in the water, dip down to your waist, wave your hands in the water, and then get out? Do you insist on listening to a Philadelphia radio station on the beach, even when it sounds like noise from a World War II field radio? Do you engage in any kind of relationship with seagulls, feeding them, chasing them, etc.? Now, if you answered yes to any of those questions, you might be a shooby. Now, if you want to know if you're a fishing shooby, I devised a few questions of my own. Do you roll a surf cart full of tackle and three 10-foot rods onto a crowded beach and soak bloodworms for croakers right where everyone is swimming? Do you attempt to walk out onto a wet, snot-covered jetty, carrying a 6-foot spinning rod and wearing Sperry topsiders that have no tread whatsoever? Do you repeatedly bomb a tuna-sized plug under the bridge, directly into the wakes of 300 jet skis and ski boats at noon during a dead low tide and expect something to eat that? If you answered yes to any of those questions, I've got an old shoebox full of banjo minnows with your name on it.
Look, man, if it'll get me a shoebox full of vintage banjos, I will strap on some topsiders and go jetty skiing tomorrow. Hook it up. Send them.
You won't get very far. Just a couple rocks out and you'll bite it. That's usually what happens. But dude, if you like vintage banjos, I have some. I could actually arrange that. But speaking of vintage and flexing, Miles is going to see us out this week with our end of the line segment, where he's going to discuss an old bait that you might legitimately find in an old shoebox in your grandpa's cedar chest, but that also paved the way for decades of chest beating over one's skills to rope hog bass.
Fishy, 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 fishy!
Well, that's not loud enough, Bert.
When I was 6 years old, my holy grail was a 5-pound largemouth bass. My Uncle Bob had one on his wall, a gape-mouthed green and black emblem of his fishing greatness. Now, as a grown man, I realized that a 5-pound largemouth is a respectable northern specimen, but nothing awe-inspiring, and that this particular skin mount, an amateur garage job done by a buddy of his at bargain cost, is actually far from exceptional. But 35 years ago, I didn't know any of that. I idolized my uncle and would sit on the musty cabin couch staring at his fish and ask him to tell me the tale of its capture again. It happened in the spring in the shallow back bay of the small Wisconsin lake where I first learned to fish. We never caught anything in that bay because when I was there in the summer, the bass were in deeper water, but I would still make my uncle take me back there at least once a year and have him show me the down log where on a fateful day in the late 70s, he caught 2 trophy bass and a handful of casts, one weighing 4.5 pounds and the other, the wall hanger, coming in over 5. He caught both fish on the same purple rubber worm. Older listeners will remember the worms I'm talking about. They came pre-rigged with a leader threaded from the nose of the worm through the body attached to 2 or 3 hooks that stuck out of the belly. Sometimes the hooks had thin wire weed guards on them. Sometimes the leader came dressed with other fish attractors like beads, a spinner blade, or a propeller. Back then, we called them rubber worms, even though they weren't actually made of rubber. Over time, I've noticed that the terminology has changed to more accurately describe what we fish. Most people call them plastic worms, or just plastics now. Only the real old heads still talk about rubber. Synthetic worms go back a very long time. The first American patent on an artificial worm was submitted in 1877, and it actually was made of rubber. But real rubber worms never took off. Rubber is relatively stiff and does a poor job imitating the supple juiciness of an annelid undulating in the water. For nearly a century, anglers and lure inventors struggled to find a fake alternative that worked as well as a live dirt snake. Once that finally happened, however, it changed sport fishing more substantially than just about any other new technology in history, except the fish hook itself. Nothing flexes in modern fishing like soft plastics. The man credited with inventing the first plastic worm is Nick Cream, who came up with his prototype in 1949. Some evidence suggests, however, that a man named David DeLong may have actually figured it out 3 years before Cream. But DeLong was not as successful at marketing his creations. Lore also claims DeLong as the first person to scent his worms with anise oil, a tidbit I have to mention as a nod to our resident striper expert, Bob the Garbage Man Bertanananinuski. While soft plastics really gained popularity and came into their own in the American South, they are Midwestern in origin. DeLong was from Indiana, and Cream hailed from Ohio, where he worked as a machinist. The mid-20th century saw the peak of American industry. Guys like Cream and DeLong understood industrial design and production. They also had enough disposable income to go fishing on the weekends and enough moxie and confidence to dream of quitting their day jobs and making a living at what they truly loved. Cream saw his opportunity in an emerging new chemistry.
Plastics.
Exactly how do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics.
Story goes that Cream paid a visit to DuPont Chemicals in Cleveland, and a lab tech gave him some chemicals to take home. How exactly he talked his way into walking out with a few buckets of proprietary chemicals to play with remains unclear. Maybe he paid the guy off. Maybe they shared a couple nips from a pocket flask. Maybe Cream was just that smooth. Maybe the story is total BS, but it makes a good story, so I'm sticking with it. Nick Cream and his wife Cosma spent the next year playing with polymers, pigments, and oils in their kitchen. Each time they thought they had a viable mixture, Cream would carry a vat of it down to the basement and pour it into a mold he made from a steel model of a real nightcrawler. In 1951, the couple took their first plastic worm to market. Like I said, Cream Lure wasn't the only company making similar products with pre-harnessed plastic worms, but they also sold unrigged replacement worms. And a few years later, an unknown bass angler fishing on Lake Tyler, one of the many newly created reservoirs in East Texas, came up with a rigging technique that would make Nick and Cosma Cream's worms world famous. That anonymous angler removed the brass eyelet from a bell sinker, threaded his line through the weight, tied on a bare hook, poked that hook through the nose of one of Cream's replacement worms, pushed it through, turned it around, and inserted the hook point and barb into the worm's soft belly so that both were hidden within the supple plastic. The Texas rig was born. By 1959, Cream worms were the hottest commodity in the Lone Star State. Selling for a buck a piece, which translates to about $9 today, Cream Lure was making good money. And a year later, they moved their headquarters from Akron, Ohio to Tyler, Texas. Cream Lures achieved early success by being the first large-scale plastic bait manufacturer, but competition caught up quickly. Cream had to find new ways to stay ahead of the spreading sea of soft plastic lure options hitting the shelves. He recognized the marketing power of influencers a half century before anyone ever used that term. Cream tracked down the best local anglers and started paying them to travel all over the South, showing off the effectiveness of soft plastic baits and teaching others how to use them. He also targeted the pros and allegedly struck the first angler endorsement deal with John Powell, who he paid $18,000 to fish Cream worms on the BASS series in 1967. Additionally, Cream conscripted Bill Dance, who endorsed the worms at tournaments, events, and on his long-running television show. Nick Cream died in 1984. He's been inducted into the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, the Texas Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, and the Texas Freshwater Fisheries Center. More importantly, though, every time an angler rigs up a soft plastic bait, which is to say thousands of times a day, all over the world, they're unknowingly paying homage to a machinist from Ohio who wanted to build a better worm. So that's it for this week. If you're staring into the mirror, trying to get that beach bod to pop in just the right ways, remember, never suggest your guide's fish finders on demo mode. Bring your own lunch when creeping on pay lakes with strangers. If you decide instead to take that lunch to the Jersey Shore, don't pack it in a shoebox. And Nick Cream and his inventions flexed harder than Macho Man Randy Savage.
But the cream will rise to the top, oh yeah.
How perfect was that clip. Anyway, right after you slather your bleach white skin with a quart of SPF 2000, feel free to share a Salmon item, bar nomination, awkward photo, or newsy bit with us at bent@themeateater.com. We've also got eyes on those Degenerate Angler and Bent podcast hashtags on the gram, and using them is the fastest way to score stickers from us.
We also hope you've gotten eyes on the new fish hoodies and t-shirts
in
your store,
mm-hmm.
because they will look great on you while you are jamming out to the Bent Spotify music playlist on the beach this summer.
That's right. They'll also really bring out the shit and that shit-eating grin you love to flash while flexing on the 12-year-olds bass fishing at the local golf course pond.